Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio. This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovec. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Well, two explosions we know outside of Kabul's international airport. We've talked about deaths, Americans, as well as Afghanis. Let's get an update on this continuously unfolding situation and crisis. With us right now is Bloomberg News National Security Team Leader Bill Ferries, along with Catherine Zimmerman, fellow at the conservative think tank American Enterprise Institute. She covers terrorism and foreign and defense policy, both on the phone in D.C. And we should remind you that we are awaiting a briefing from the White House as well as the Pentagon. As soon as they do begin, we will take you there live. In the meantime, Bill, thanks for being here with Tim and myself. What's the latest that we know in terms of the situation in Afghanistan as well as the casualties?
Well, we know that several U.S. troops have been killed in the blast, and we believe more wounded. And obviously, the Taliban have said that there were at least 13 Afghans killed and several dozen wounded in the blast, and I think we all expect those numbers to rise in the coming hours. We have had reports that planes are still leaving the Kabul airport, but obviously this puts a big hold on efforts by U.S. and NATO forces to get more people out of the country. And we're expecting, as you said, a White House and Pentagon briefing within the next 30 minutes to an hour here, so we should get an update on how this is affecting what the latest numbers are and how this may affect President Biden's plans to withdraw by August 31st.
Hey, Bill, what do we know about potentially the group or groups behind this and their relationship with the Taliban?
Well, the Taliban themselves have come out and said that they think that one of the ISIS offshoots is possibly responsible for this. They say they're investigating. I mean, these blasts happened in, you know, outside of the airport perimeter in the area now controlled by the Taliban. And throughout the conflict over the last decade, you have had you've had Taliban bombings in Afghanistan, you've had ISIS bombings in Afghanistan, and some of those ISIS bombings have been against Taliban targets. So it's been a complicated picture there, but the Taliban and ISIS have been at each other at the same time they have been going after foreign forces.
Catherine, I want to bring you into the conversation here. You cover terrorism, you cover foreign and defense policy. Was any withdrawal by American U.S. forces going to be difficult from Afghanistan, no matter what the timing?
It was certainly going to be difficult, but as we look back at how the withdrawal was done, there was a lot that could have been done better.
Well, why don't you expand upon that?
We were looking at a situation where the U.S. drew down in a matter of months 2,500 troops to next to nothing, and we still had American civilian personnel on the ground, and we're really placing our hands on our safety in the hands of the Afghan National Security Forces, and those, as we well know, collapsed very rapidly. But what was missed in all of that is, of course, the enabling capabilities that the United States provided the Afghans that were yanked as the United States pulled back.
Well, we certainly can't go back in time, and the deadline that's looming right now is August 31st, and that's the date that the United States has agreed to with the Taliban to remove the American presence there. I'm wondering how, Catherine, what happened there today not changes that deadline, but changes what happens over the next few days and the thousands of people who still remain in Afghanistan that need to get out.
The attack today will certainly make it more challenging for the people who need to get out of Afghanistan to get out. The United States had already changed how it was bringing Americans to the airport because of fears that the soft target, the crowds unprotected outside of the airport perimeter, would be targeted by the Islamic State Khorasan, as we saw. And that had certainly slowed down how we were getting people to the airport. So if we're looking at the August 31 deadline, there are things that we need to keep in mind. The first is that our European partners have already said that they're basically phasing down evacuations because the U.S. military won't be able to promise security. And certainly, as we're looking at the security situation today, even the security the U.S. military brought was very tenuous.
Bill Ferries, you know, with this situation rapidly deteriorating, what can we expect? Are you hearing anything from U.S. officials when it comes to potentially upping once again the amount of American troops in Afghanistan?
We're not hearing anything like that. I think there's going to be a calculus at the White House about, you know, they've been saying for days that the longer troops are there, the more at risk they are, the more dangerous the situation becomes. So I would for now expect them to stick with that August 31st deadline to try to get everybody out. But I agree, it's made it much more difficult to try to get any Americans who remain in Afghanistan who want to leave. And we really don't know the universe of those people, whether it's 500, 1,500 or more. But it will make it much more difficult to get them out, especially if they're not already in Kabul.
All right. We're going to continue this conversation. Bill, I know you've got a lot on your plate today, so we're going to let you go. Bill Ferries, he's National Security Team Leader at Bloomberg News, keeping us up to date on the moving situation in Afghanistan, joining us on the phone from Washington, D.C. We're going to come back, though, with Catherine Zimmerman. She's fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, a conservative think tank based there in the nation's capital. She's joining us from D.C. You are listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Carol Masser, along with Tim Stenovic in our Interactive Brokers studio. A reminder that we are expected to hear a briefing from the White House as well as the Pentagon on Afghanistan. We will take you there live as soon as it happens. This is Bloomberg Radio.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Crossing the Bloomberg terminal, a headline from the Associated Press, 11 Marines and a Navy medic killed in the Afghanistan, explosions in that country. So continuing to get some updates, Tim, on the situation there.
Yeah, and we'll continue to bring those updates as soon as we get them. As Carol mentioned moments ago, we are awaiting a press conference from the White House and also one at the Pentagon. We'll bring those to you live when we get them as well. In the meantime, let's get back to Catherine Zimmerman, a fellow at the Conservative American Enterprise Institute, joining us on the phone from Washington, D.C. Catherine, I want to try to understand from you to what extent you think the President Biden's hands were tied, at least in the withdrawal, not necessarily the timing, but the fact that the United States had to withdraw from Afghanistan, given that the U.S. and Taliban signed a deal back in the early part of 2020 in order to end this war and for the U.S. to ultimately withdraw. That, of course, happened under the Trump administration.
President Biden made his own decision to withdraw, and I think that has been missed in all of this. The Trump administration did sign a deal, but the Taliban was not upholding its end of the deal. And the two key points that the Taliban weren't executing was breaking ties with al-Qaeda. We actually saw the Taliban continuing to support al-Qaeda and al-Qaeda spreading in the country after it had signed the deal. And the second point was reducing the level of violence inside of Afghanistan. And certainly the idea was to make space for a political negotiation that would have allowed some sort of transitionary government. And the Taliban simply escalated. And we know the impact of that now.
So Catherine, what would you say what would you rather have had the Biden administration do when it entered office in January of this year? Would you like to have seen U.S. troops stay there?
I've advocated for the ongoing light footprint that the U.S. had gotten to by the point that the Biden administration took office. We had 2,500 troops inside of Afghanistan, which sounds like a lot, except when you look at what they were doing, which was primarily supporting the Afghan National Security Forces, who were doing the brunt of the fighting against the Taliban. And then, of course, the part that matters for the United States, our troops were the ones with the high-end counterterrorism capabilities going after the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and Islamic State elements that were posing terror threats.
But I want to go back to Catherine. You know, there are so many different groups within Afghanistan. I think 14 different ethnicities. There's just so many different groups. Would it have been impossible to ultimately get an ideal situation there? And with the Taliban kind of following through on its commitments in order for the U.S. to withdraw anytime soon?
Yes, I think when the Trump administration negotiated the deal, it was very clear that there wasn't going to be a political resolution for the reasons that you lay out. And the fact fundamentally that the United States had shifted years prior from engaging on the ongoing civil war in Afghanistan. And I think that's something that we don't actually separate in our heads enough, is the counterterrorism fight that the United States has in Afghanistan and the civil war against the Taliban that was ongoing.
You understand this situation. You understand this region of the world. Thomas Friedman of the New York Times recently writing in an opinion piece, you know, but citing how more than 70% of Afghanistan's population is under 25 years old. Most of them, he writes, know nothing about the Taliban. How will that create the future of Afghanistan?
It's a great question. And as we're looking at what the future of Afghanistan looks like, you know, the Taliban have taken power again, but the Afghanistan today is far different from the one 20 years ago. And as you mentioned, most of the population have very different expectations than the population did when the Taliban was in power in 1996 through 2001. So there are much higher demands on any government of Afghanistan today, where people in the urban centers in Kabul and other major cities do expect government service to be provided. So that's one of the reasons why we're watching the Taliban's actions carefully, and why the Taliban are so worried about the economic collapse that has followed their takeover of the country.
What kind of economic pressure can the international community put on the Taliban in order to use sticks more so than carrots, or perhaps even carrots, to push the Taliban in a direction that the Afghan people want?
We've already seen the international community try to use some of those sticks, where, of course, the IMF has kind of frozen ongoing relations until the situation with the Afghan government is settled. And the amount of assistance that has been provided by the international community to Afghanistan has helped to prop up the government that was in power. So almost all Western nations have frozen that for the time being. My big concern is that we are looking at a growing humanitarian situation. And, of course, there is a careful balance between our national security and helping precipitate a right. humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan. What we might see is humanitarian assistance needing to flow into Afghanistan, which the Taliban will certainly use to build their own legitimacy.
Catherine, thank you so much for being with us. Catherine Zimmerman, fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, with us on the phone from D.C.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
The international cover of Bloomberg Business Week this week, it's about September next month, how it promised a return to normal, Tim, but we're just a few days away and it's not going to happen.
It's not. I was going to say you got to travel outside of the United States, perhaps North America, to see this cover. But you actually don't, because it's available at Bloomberg.com/businessweek and also available, of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal. It is a fantastic cover to the International Edition. It's a calendar of September. all these dates are circled but scribbled out, and that's exactly how I think a lot of employees and certainly offices and managers feel about the return to work.
We're still dealing with the health pandemic, and you know, Afghanistan, that crisis also reminding us that things are not normal as well. So let's get into it. The story by Bloomberg News U.S. economic reporter Reed Pickert and Bloomberg U.S. economy reporter Olivia Rockman. Reed, she joins us now on the phone in Washington. It is such a smart story, Reed. We really thought, if you go back 6-8 months, we thought September it was going to be quote unquote normal.
Yes. So thank you so much for having me. So yeah, the idea for this story mainly came from the fact that back several months ago, I think May is kind of when I think of it as being the main moment where we were all kind of looking to September and the fall more generally to be a little bit more normal and at least a turning point of some kind for the U.S. economy. And back then, I mean, with the data that we had, it looked like vaccinations were rising rapidly, and it looked like that we'd reach that 75% threshold of vaccination of the population in September. It looked like schools were going to be back in person and be normal. And a lot of companies firmed up their return to office dates. And I think the whole point of this story was pointing out that that is not the circumstances that we're dealing with as we're rolling into September now.
Yeah,
Delta has thrown a huge wrench in that.
Right. Companies, as you write, like Alphabet's Google, BlackRock, they've pushed return to office dates to October. Delta has disrupted already strained supply chains. China temporarily closed a terminal at one of the world's busiest ports to quarantine dock workers. That delayed shipments of materials that businesses and factories need. So take us into the economic impact of this, the economic implications of this. We talked a little bit about them a few minutes ago. If we're not, you know, and just very minorly, right? If we're not commuting in, we're not hitting tolls in municipalities, we're not spending money on lunches outside of the office. But beyond that, what are the bigger implications?
So I think the bigger implications for now is that we don't really know. I mean, we won't start getting a lot of the data that starts to show us what August looks like until we get into September. And we also don't know if the Delta wave is going to follow a similar kind of peak as the UK did, or if it will follow a different path. But we pointed this out in the story, but some of the high frequency indicators are starting to show some signs that consumer behavior is changing a little bit. And I think when we think about the impact of consumer behavior changing, we need to keep in mind of what the profile for economic growth is right now. So for a huge portion of the pandemic, from consumer spending was based on goods. But now consumer spending is wholly dependent on this snapback in services spending. And even just some changes in consumers' behavior, not dining out as much, not traveling, those kind of things that we thought were going to continue really hot into the fall, that could have pretty big implications.
All right. So as we all keep crossing our fingers and our legs and our arms in hopes of getting back to normal sooner rather than later, what visibility do we have? Because it certainly feels different, Reed, than where we were, of course, a year ago or even 8 months ago.
I think it's what, you know, Powell has talked about this before, and I think it was in the July press conference when he talked about how with every kind of new wave of Delta, there seems to be a little bit less reaction in terms of the consumer response. And I think we're certainly seeing that now because, you know, when I walk around D.C., I see full restaurants. I see a lot of people who are vaccinated and feel great about the risks that they're taking to partake in these activities. But then I also know people who are canceling their trips and are really nervous about sending their kids back to school. And so I think we're also seeing this divergence, as we've seen throughout the course of the pandemic, but we're really seeing a divergence in terms of risk assessment. And I think, you know, how we fall on that really depends on people's own comfort levels rather than, you know, geography or right. Whatever it may be.
Okay, so enter Fed Chair Jerome Powell.
Dun, 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 dun.
That's his enter music. Tomorrow, Jackson
virtually,
Hole.
His virtual entrance music.
And look, you know, if we had a cowboy hat for every time we talked about the Fed, as Carol said earlier, then we'd have, you know, we'd have spent $750 million on cowboy hats this year. But the fact is investors are awaiting what he says tomorrow. And I'm wondering how the high frequency data, how the decline of passengers going through TSA checkpoints or people in hotspots who are not dining out with OpenTable, how that changes, among other things, the way that the Fed is thinking about tapering or the way that the Fed is thinking about pulling back on some of the stimulus.
I think from the perspective of tapering, it doesn't seem to have had a huge impact. I mean, the biggest clear impact that Delta's had on the Fed recently is the fact that Jackson Hole shifted to being virtual from in-person in a very short amount of time and right before it was actually happening. But in terms of what that means for tapering, I think there's been a lot of Fed speak out recently where folks are encouraging tapering sooner rather than later. So I don't know how much Delta is playing into that decision, but I'm definitely curious to see how Powell talks about that in his Jackson Hole speech, since he definitely got peppered with a lot of questions about Delta in the last press conference.
Well, here's a number for us, and you've got it in your story. You talk about the progressive think tank, the Century Foundation, estimates 7.5 million workers will lose all unemployment benefits on September 6th when the main pandemic programs end. That's a lot of Americans.
It is. And how do the ripple effects that it has throughout the economy, and also what does it do for the jobless who potentially do go and start working again?
All right. It's a great story, a great read, and a lot of information in it. Reed, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Of course, that's Bloomberg News U.S. economic reporter Reed Pickard joining us on the phone from Washington, D.C. It is the international cover story, but as you said, you can find it at Bloomberg.com.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
He's gonna drive you home.
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
Yes, it is time for the Drive to the Close, and I'm just looking at the equity trade. Doug, of course, just breaking down the numbers. We're hovering near our lows of the session, as Doug mentioned, down about 0.5% on the S&P. Dow down 172 points, also down 0.5%. Same thing for the NASDAQ on a percentage basis, but again, hovering near our highs on a day where we've seen a couple of explosions in Afghanistan. Let's get to it with Randy Watts.
Randy Watts is Chief Investment Strategist at O'Neill Global Advisors, joining us once again on the phone from Miami. Wow, Randy, you heard me take a deep breath, a big sigh there, because that's the type of day it has certainly been like. When we talk about macro, we often talk about what's happening with trade and what's happening, of course, with the Federal Reserve and with the virus. But today was a different story with those two explosions in Afghanistan. We did see the equity markets reach session lows just following that news. How did you watch it?
Well, first off, thanks for having me back. And I do want to say my thoughts and prayers go out to the families of the servicemen and women and others who were killed in those two bombings today in Kabul. Obviously, it's a very bad situation. My understanding is they have over 5,000 people at the airport right now. They're still trying to get out. So it's a very tenuous situation. And our thoughts and prayers are with those people, and hope we can get them evacuated safely. I think what's happening in Afghanistan is a big deal. I think it raises the specter that there is going to be more terrorist activity the U.S. is going to have to deal with, that Afghanistan is not stabilized, and it's not going to be as quick and easy an exit as maybe some of the procrastinators thought. So I am a little worried about that, and I think anytime there's geopolitical instability, that's bad for markets.
So, let me just jump into that a little more, Randy. Does that mean that you see this playing out as a market story as well? Like, what effect does that instability actually have on equity markets and financial markets?
I think it just adds another kind of negative element to some of the other macro negative elements we're dealing with COVID. I don't think it's the dominant story. I think the dominant story remains COVID and how we're going to get through that and recover from that. But I think it does just remind people that the world's a dangerous place. And when the U.S. withdraws from places, oftentimes bad things happen. And I think we maybe haven't heard the end of things that are going to affect the U.S. and Afghanistan. Just because we leave doesn't mean there can't be other negative occurrences there that crop up.
Well, and what's interesting is I was thinking about this as I watched the market trade, Randy, and good to be talking with you again. I was kind of comparing it to the first Persian Gulf War, where we saw a huge market impact, obviously, in the energy markets. I think about after 9/11, to have a terrorism incident right here on U.S. domestic soil, a much more severe market impact initially. And I'm not saying, and I agree with you, my hearts and thoughts are going out to those friends and families of anyone who has lost their lives in Afghanistan. But I do feel like the market decline has not been uncontrollable, if you will. It's been very measured. And I'm trying to understand what that tells us.
Well, I think right now the market still isn't sure exactly how Afghanistan's going to play out over the longer run. I think the fear is, does that become a country that becomes a breeding ground for further terrorist activity, or does it stabilize? I think that is obviously a question that's up in the air. And whether or not we're going to really meet this August 31st deadline, which we've imposed on ourselves to get all of our personnel and people out of there. So I think that remains to be seen. I think this just does remind people, though, that the world's a dangerous place. And mm-hmm. when the U.S. withdraws from places, oftentimes that lets negative parties fester or grow.
All right, so if we can separate ourselves from this, and I understand it's not so easy to do, but if we can think about what else is going on, and I do want to mention a headline crossing President Biden to speak about Afghanistan from the White House today, so we are monitoring that as well. If we separate out what's going on in Afghanistan right now, the major talking point this week, Randy, as you would guess, has been about Jackson Hole and what we might get from Jay Powell. What are you anticipating, if anything, and how it might maybe impact your market think?
So I think we're still going to hear from Powell. And again, I don't have a crystal ball. I'm often wrong. But I think we're still going to hear from him that the taper is going to start at some time in the fourth quarter this year. And the Fed, I think, really wants to be done by the end of next year. And so the question is really the pace of that. St. Louis Federal Reserve Bank President Bullard today talked about a quicker taper where they would be done by the end of Q1. I think that's unlikely. I think especially given what's going on with the Delta variant of COVID, that they're not going to move that quickly. If you remember, the last time around they did this, they did it in 2013. They started it in January of 2014, and they finished in October of 2014. It took 10 months. They were buying about $85 billion a month back then. Right now, we're doing about $120 billion a month. I do think it's going to be more of like that kind of a pace of taper than it's going to be one where they try to do it all in 6 months. But I think the Fed does want it to finish in 2022, because I think they want the flexibility to raise rates if they need to in 2023.
So what is the market listening for with Fed Chair Powell's virtual remarks tomorrow?
Right now, the market is expecting that the taper starts in December and that they do about $10 billion a month in reductions. So it takes them 12 months and they finish kind of December next year, November next year. I think if the rate is different than that, or if it starts earlier and later, that can affect the market. I think if it starts much later, that could upset market participants because they feel like inflation continues to get a little bit out of hand. If it's a lot faster than people expected, that could also cause a little bit of a dislocation. One thing that's important for everyone to look at is, remember, tomorrow we're going to get the personal consumption price index for July. If we go back and remember, the June one was up 4%, which was the largest increase since July 2008. The forecast for July is up 4.1. So it's possible that we're going to get a negative number there tomorrow, and that's going to make market participants anxious about when the Fed does start to taper, so they can try to maybe eventually move ahead on the inflation.
So having said that, we have talked a lot, Randy, about investors coming in and buying the dip here. How constructive is this market to be a buyer right now, or would you rather be a seller?
I think that the thing about the market is it's not quite as good as it appears on the surface. Only 64% of the S&P is above its 50-day, but only 36% of the NASDAQ is above its 50-day. So that's actually not a great number. I think the issues are really twofold. First is, when does Delta peak? And the second is, what kind of stimulus we're going to get out of Washington? Are we going to get both of those bills out of Congress, or are we just going to get one of them, and how that's going to impact the economy? I think people are in a little bit of a wait-and-see mode on both of these issues, and that's why they've been moving into some of the bigger, more stable names, particularly tech.
All right, wait, you have to repeat that again, because Tim and I are going to want to say this again. It says only 64% of the S&P is above its 50-day, and how much of the NASDAQ?
Only 36% of the NASDAQ is above its 50-day moving average.
Okay.
That means breadth has not been good, particularly in the NASDAQ. Investors are rotating into larger cap, more defensive stocks, particularly in technology, while they try to get a handle on what's going to happen with all three things you mentioned, the Fed, the Delta, and what kind of stimulus we're going to get out of Washington. I think investors are maybe holding some money back until they see that, so they can then make better, more informed decisions.
Got to run. Always wish we had more time. Randy, be well. Randy Watts, Chief Investment Strategist at O'Neill Global Advisors, on the phone in Miami.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.